Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the only podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. Your host, Roberto Mazza, will bring you guests discussing their relationship with the Holy City. A journey through history, society, feelings, and hopes for the future. Follow the podcast on all social media platforms at Jerusalem Unplugged.
Welcome to Jerusalem Unplugged, the podcast dedicated to Jerusalem, its history, and its people. I'm Roberto Mazza, your host, and today my guest is Bedros Dermatoussis. Bedros is an associate professor of modern Middle Eastern history at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. He's the author of an important book about Ottoman history, Shattered Dreams of Revolution, but he's also the co-editor of the Routledge Handbook of Jerusalem, which is my companion. He's always on my desk as I get a lot of information about the city of Jerusalem. More importantly, Bedros was born and raised in Jerusalem. Bedros, welcome.
Welcome, Roberto. Thank you very much for inviting me to your podcast.
So, Bedros, the usual question that I ask to all of my guests, what is your Jerusalem? In other words, what is your connection with the city?
Well, I was born and raised in the Muslim quarter of Jerusalem, so the east side, and there is a major difference, as you know, between the west side of Jerusalem and the east side. I was raised in the Muslim quarter with the Islamic culture, with Christian culture, and I went to school at the Armenian quarter, and I graduated from the school in the Armenian quarter. And for me, Jerusalem is home. The old city of Jerusalem is home, homeland. And it's very close to my heart. I spent many part of my life in the old city. I grew up in the Via Dolorosa section, which is close to Al-Wad Street, Shara Al-Wad. And, my life was East Jerusalem to that extent. I rarely went to West Jerusalem. I'm a graduate of the Saint Tarkmanchat School, the Armenian School, the Holy Translator School in the Armenian Quarter. I spent a lot of time in the Armenian Quarter. I went to the Armenian Social Club there, the Homentmen. That was kind of an important place for me, both politically, ideologically. And my first exposure to the West, to the West Jerusalem, was when I started my undergraduate studies at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. So that was a kind of a transformation, being exposed now to the Israeli culture, politics. But again, I remained very much embedded within the Palestinian culture, Islamic culture in the old city of Jerusalem, in the Islamic quarter. And there is a major difference between those who grew up within the Armenian quarter, in the confines of the Armenian convent, and those who grew up in the different parts of the old city or outside the city. If you read my article, Armenians of Palestine between 1918 and 1948, you would see that there are many classes of Armenians. So you have Armenians who are living outside the old city. Those are well-to-do Armenians who started moving out of the old city during the interwar period and lived in the rich neighborhoods the German colony, the Greek colony, and other parts of West Jerusalem. This is the beginning of the formation of a Palestinian bourgeoisie within the West Jerusalem. And most of these houses were confiscated actually after 1948, as you know. Then you have Armenians who lived in the Armenian quarter lived there, and their children grew up there. And then you have another category of Armenians who grew up outside the confines of the Armenian convent or the Armenian quarter. Those usually have a different type of identity. You know, it's Armenians are a minority, but within these minority, there are multiple levels of minority. You are the part of the majority of the minority, let's say, which is the Armenian Orthodox, then living in the Armenian convent or living outside the confines of the old city. Then you have Armenian Catholics who live around the Muslim neighborhood, Islamic quarter, because there is the Armenian Catholic convent there in the Islamic, in the Muslim quarter. And those have a kind of a different identity, all right? So these are micro differences, but you would feel them if you are part of the community, all right? So I rarely went to the West Jerusalem as a kid. Of course, I grew up during the first Intifada, and I felt the first Intifada very closely. I know people who were killed by the IDF soldiers. I grew up in a period of conflict. Unlike other Armenians who lived in the Armenian quarter, were in a much safer situation because the Armenian convent, the cathedral, where many Armenians live, families, actually closes the door at 10, the convent door, and that's it. They're inside safe. But the other Armenians who live in the Muslim quarter, other places, were more exposed and vulnerable to the conflict. So as an Armenian, it didn't make difference because if you're not an Israeli, you're the other. So I used to be stopped by the IDF, checked and harassed sometimes. And of course, because even if I told them I'm Armenian, it doesn't matter. It didn't matter because if you're not an Israeli, you're the other. And the other is the other, the Palestinian, the Arabs, the whatever you are, Christian or not Christian, so it's the other. Then when I graduated from high school, the Armenian school, I attended the Hebrew University. That was a major transformation for me. I think Hebrew University provides an excellent education. My Hebrew wasn't that excellent, so I had to take Hebrew classes at the same time as I was pursuing my undergraduate. And the teaching language was Hebrew, as a matter of fact. And it was very difficult for me to really co-opt with the challenge of understanding the lectures, which were, for example, I did an undergraduate in political science and Islamic and Middle Eastern studies. Imagine you're sitting in your first day in the class and the professor, Ze'ev Sternel, who passed away a few years ago, is talking about political philosophy, and you don't understand. You don't understand two words within the sentence, you're gone. But I had close friends, and those friends happened to be from Latin America, Jews from Latin America who were facing the same problem, and also Palestinians from East Jerusalem who attended the Hebrew University. As a matter of fact, there's a major contingent now of Palestinians from East Jerusalem who attend the Hebrew University. As a matter of fact, there are about 200 students from East Jerusalem who are doing the Mechina, which is in Rothberg School, is the preparatory program to enter the Hebrew University. And then I got obsessed with the Middle East history, culture, Islamic culture, and specifically Islam as a religion, culture, entity. And hence, when I graduated from the Hebrew University, I started my graduate studies there. And then the second Intifada began in the year of 2000. And then I decided that I have to leave Jerusalem. I went to pursue my PhD at Columbia University. But Jerusalem remains an important part of my life. As a matter of fact, for Armenians, they have a unique identity, which is the Jerusalemite identity. They call themselves as Sarimahai, which means Armenians of Jerusalem. And this identity is different than the Armenians who live in Haifa or Yaffa. And for Armenians of Haifa and Yaffa, they consider the Jerusalem as the nucleus of Armenian identity, culture, and politics. So again, the Armenians of Jerusalem, Armenian Jerusalem to that extent, I call it Armenian Jerusalem because Armenian presence in Jerusalem goes back to 2,000 years. Started with the Armenian contingent with Alexander the Great, who settled the army, settled that battalion, settled in what's today the Armenian Quarter. It became to be known as the Armenian Street, and eventually we have the beginning Christian Armenian heritage, which starts in the first century and so on. By the fourth century, there is a strong presence because Armenians from Armenia actually came as pilgrims and stayed there. So eventually you have the formation of the Armenian Patriarchate and the local Armenian community. Now there is a difference between the local Armenian community and those who came after the Armenian genocide in 1915. The locals called themselves as Karakatsi, meaning the local inhabitants, and they're much more emerged with the Palestinian culture. Their first language is Arabic, and their cuisine is to a certain extent very similar to the Palestinian cuisine, and they speak Armenian in a different dialect. Whereas those who came after the genocide were Armenians from different parts of the Ottoman Empire, from different parts of Cilicia, from Aintab, Marash. For example, when my grandparents came from Lebanon in the early 1930s, and during the Mandate period, they settled in the same neighborhood that we still live in the same house that belongs to Husseini family. All right, so, you know, Husseini and Nashashibi, they own a lot of properties. It's Waqf A'ili, as they say. And to that extent, they brought with them their own cuisine, their own culture. But this does not mean that the locals referred to them actually as Zuwar, as the visitors. So you have the locals who have a different identity, and then the Zuwar who came, who didn't speak a word of Arabic. They spoke Turkish among each other and to a certain extent Armenian. But they came from bringing with them their cultures, their professions, and eventually started growing and dominating the Armenian community with Jerusalem. But even though that they came from the Ottoman Empire, still they brought with them their own separate identities, which are based as on regional identities. This means that, for example, my grandfather, who came from Marash in Cilicia, he attended the Marash Club, which is today there is the Select restaurant near the police station, and that used to be the Marash Club, and those Marash Armenians who used to go there. One thing we have to understand that usually people don't really perceive it is that Armenians of Jerusalem have hybrid identity, or at least used to have. I do consider myself as Marash Situ, as a descendant of Marash Armenian. You might be a Palestinian, you might have influenced by Arab culture, you might be Marash, you might be Jerusalemite, you might be Christian, you might be Orthodox Christian or Catholic Christian. There is a multiple level of hybridity within Armenian identity. And Armenians of Jerusalem are very cosmopolitan community. And I wouldn't consider identity as a solid factor. And that's how I grew up, with multiple identities, with hybrid identities, five languages, I should say: Armenian, Arabic, English, Hebrew, and Turkish. Of course, the Turkish that was spoken in the house is Ottoman Turkish. It's a Marash dialect. And that's how I grew up, with the basis of Turkish. And then I pursued learning Ottoman, and I'm fluent in Turkish too. And add to that different languages too. I was part of Jerusalem. And, you know, Jerusalem, it's not an isolated city. Millions of tourists visit from different parts of the world. So it makes a major, major place of node actually of international point of interaction and communication. And growing up on Via Dolorosa, which is part of the pilgrimage route of all Christian pilgrims who visit Jerusalem, makes a lot of difference of understanding the cultural importance of Jerusalem.
I want to say wow. First of all, because you answered a lot of my questions that I was going to ask you. And secondly, because you have such a fascinating, not only life, but also all of these identities that connect to each other and made me think about a puzzle and how you're able to, not only you, but the community, to keep that puzzle working. And I want to ask you something about, you know, the perception of the Armenians and of the Armenian Jerusalem, because from the outside, often you just get the sense that there is an Armenian quarter and there are Armenians in Jerusalem, but we don't know much about them. So is there an Armenian Jerusalem?
Yes, there is Armenian Jerusalem, actually, because it has a unique identity. As once upon a time, Armenians of Jerusalem used to have 72 convents in Jerusalem, churches. This is from the 1,000 years ago. And even during the school years, during the high school, we used to take one class taught by Dr. Roberta Irvine, an Armenologist, a very prominent Armenologist. She teaches nowadays at the St. Nerses Seminary in Armonk in New York. She taught us classical Armenian. That's another thing that's unique about Jerusalem, where we studied classical Armenian at the age of 12. And by the age of 16, we read classical Armenian texts from the 5th century. You can't find this in any school teaching classical Armenian, which was the language that was used in the 4th, 5th, 6th century until the emergence of modern West and East Armenian in the 19th century. That's another important thing. But she used to teach a course, actually, that was called Armenian Jerusalem. And the course was based on visiting sites where Armenians were present. And most of these sites are today kind of do not exist. And there are shops and other housings in these sites. But again, this is a very unique importance. I would say outside Armenia, the most precious and most important site for Armenians is Jerusalem, because of its antiquity, because of its importance of culture, religious, and don't forget that Armenians own more than Catholics, Latins or Latin Catholics, major portions of the important holy sites within Jerusalem and Bethlehem. Think of the Holy Sepulchre, for example. After the Greeks, Armenians are the most important possessors, let's say, of the holy places in holy sections of the Holy Sepulchre, more than the Catholics, who represent above billion population, whereas Armenians today are 12 million population. And this is another important factor about the Armenian Jerusalem. It's not only about Jerusalem as a holy city, but again about Armenian presence in Jerusalem and the importance that Armenians have in Jerusalem in terms of religious sites, cultural sites. And again, until today, we have a pilgrimage that still goes on into Jerusalem by Armenians who visit Jerusalem as part of visiting also Armenian Jerusalem, not only as the visit to the Holy Land, but also visiting Armenian Jerusalem and being introduced to the Armenian treasures and the culture of Jerusalem from a different perspective. So that's why being an Armenian from Jerusalem, it's a unique trait, I should say, that's different from Armenians of Paris. Or, you know, most of the other Armenian communities are newly established communities outside the Middle East, let's say. But Jerusalem has a history of thousands of years. Even in Armenian pilgrims who came, you would find their epigraphies in some of the caves in the Sinai desert, you know. And these are important factors which people don't know, actually, usually, because from outside, there's a kind of a misperception of who are Armenians. Once upon a time, there's this professor from Jordan who teaches in an Ivy League school. when he found out that I'm Armenian, he said, oh, Armenians, yeah, I know, ceramics and lahmacun, you know, it's like degrading us to the level of ceramic and another food. But that's not the case. Armenians represent a very rich culture, specifically those who were part of the Ottoman Empire. We have thousands of years of history, both academic, intellectual history, cultural history, political history, religious history. And as a matter of fact, if you know the Ottoman Empire, you would find out that the Armenians represented one of the most important advanced intellectual elite within the Ottoman Empire in terms of publications. Thousands of Armenian newspapers were published in the Ottoman Empire. Books, literatures, not only in Armenian language, but also in Armeno-Turkish, which is Ottoman written in Armenian letters. That's another kind of identity. So you have multiple identities playing around in the Ottoman Empire. And what we have today, as a matter of fact, within Jerusalem, is kind of the inheritance, the legacies of the Ottoman period. I mean, if you walk into in Jerusalem, it's you will feel the Ottoman legacy there. I mean, with the neighborhoods, with the identities, with the, and of course, one important thing that all of us know, that with the arrival of the British, these identities were detached from their national or communal importance and were re-emphasized the millet system, putting more emphasis on religious representation. And of course, this is what we have today, which is the religious representation, which I do not agree with. I think there needs to be a kind of the communal representation of the communities within Jerusalem. The same with the Greek Arab Orthodox, and the Arab Orthodox is a different case, so we can discuss that more if you're interested. But what the British did in order to divide and conquer, as you know, they emphasized the religious importance of all the communities. Hence, they rejected the Palestinian executive, whereas they accepted the Zionist executive, and all of these aim to kind of prevent a unified representation of the Palestinian community. When I say Palestinian community, I'm not only saying Muslims, but also Palestinian Christian as a unified representation. But they created the Muslim Supreme Council, appointing Hajj Amin al-Husseini, as you know. And this was a technique of divide and conquer. And that's why whatever we have today as religious representations is based on the legacy of the British, parts of colonial identity, parts of colonial techniques of divide and conquer, and which gives the utmost authority to the religious entities, who none of them actually are born in Jerusalem. The same with the Greeks, except the lower parishes in the Greek. Actually, the most prominent in the Greek case is Hanna Atallah. But in the case of the Armenians, most of them come from different parts of the globe. They're not born in Jerusalem, and hence there is, I don't feel there is a strong connection to Armenian Jerusalem or to Palestine per se, or the Palestinian land. Hence, in the 70s and 80s, there were a lot of scandals within the Armenian community, Armenian patriarchate, of selling lands to settlers and others. And until today, the Armenian community doesn't have any voice within the decision-making process. The same we could say about the Orthodox community, but the difference between the Armenians and the Orthodox, Arab Orthodox, is that you have an indigenous Arab Orthodox community, which is different from the identity of the Greek Orthodox ecclesiastical hierarchy, which comes purely from Cyprus and Greece, whereas Armenians, same and identity-wise, are the same, actually. So that's the only difference. And if you think about it today, the only community which is really, really pushing and trying to sustain its community is the Latin Patriarchy, by establishing building housings in Beit Hanina and other places in order to sustain their community, creating scholarships and many other projects. They have conservatoires which my nieces attend. And so they're really to take good care of their community. Understanding Armenian identity is a complex thing. And from the Palestinian perspective, I think there is a lot of appreciation for Armenians, specifically the Armenian contribution to Jerusalem in the post-1915 period, in terms of bringing professions, shoemaking, goldsmith, tailors, silversmith, many other professions, photography, ceramics, and of course, Armenians are very famous in photography in Jerusalem. From the first photographer, Armenian photographer who introduced photography was Patriarch Yesai in the 1860s. And thereon, you have the beginning of a major venture of photography bringing from Germany, and the panoramas that were taking of old city of Jerusalem. So a kind of a major contribution of Armenians to the culture of Palestinian culture of Jerusalem, less so to the Israeli culture, I should say, more so to the Palestinian culture. So and there is a lot of appreciation, I should say, from the Palestinian community, but the Palestinians in general towards Armenians. And I've never seen any discrimination, actually, from the Palestinians towards Armenians of Jerusalem. So there's a lot of appreciation. But again, there is also quote-unquote ignorance about the internal dynamics of the Armenian community. As you know, Armenian community is, despite the fact that we have community, but also the community within itself is divided into political parties, which mirrors the other diaspora and community political parties. And there is another point here, Roberto. I'm not sure if we can call Armenian Jerusalem as a diasporic community. This is another thing that we can discuss about theories of diaspora. And, you know, one of the most important theoreticians of Armenian, of diaspora in general, is Khachik Tololian from Wesleyan University. And he is the founder and the editor of the journal Diaspora, which is published by University of Toronto Press, backed by the Zorian Institute. And he just recently stepped down, and we have two new editors, Talar Shahinian and Sosi Kasparian, in order to explore not only the Armenian diaspora, but also the idea of diasporic communities globally, from the Tibetan to the Chinese to the Arab diaspora. But I'm not sure yet whether Armenians of Jerusalem could be called diaspora. But again, there is dual type of loyalty here. One is loyalty to the land of Jerusalem that you live in, but there is also another loyalty towards another Armenian loyalty, which is Armenia today. All right. And again, there has been a lot of disappointment and angry by the Armenian communities of both Palestine and Israel towards the Israeli government by selling weapons to Azerbaijan. And, you know, Turkish-Israeli and Israeli-Azeri relations are very, very close in terms of economy, like oil and military. And again, one thing I always would like to reemphasize here is that Palestinians usually think that Erdogan is the some of them usually call him the caliph or the leader of the Palestinian or the Arab world, with his ability of defying the colonial powers, defying Israel, defying everything and saying whatever he wants. But it's just saying, it's not doing anything. It's meant for internal consumption, external consumption. But if you think about it, there is close relations, military, business relations with Israel and other Western countries. So again, that's something that's also Turkey is having a lot of influence over East Jerusalem today in terms of buying or selling, you know, in terms of backing Palestinians. But again, I don't think it's a sincere thing. I think it's politics aimed at internal consumption, external consumption. When you speak about oppression First of all, you have to speak about the oppression that you are initiating on your minority communities within your own countries, and then lead by example, they say, and then talk about the oppressions of others.
Yeah, you were just saying something about it made me think about a conference I went a few years back, organized by the Turkish government. And I chose to go because I was really curious about the narratives they were going to present. And I remember that distinct feeling of, you know, talking about Kudus, Jerusalem, Jerusalem in Turkish, but also forgetting about the reality of the relationship between Turkey and Israel, not only the number of flights that take place on a daily basis, but also the fact that exactly at that moment, the new palace, the new presidential palace, which I remember calling the Imperial Palace, the entire security was actually built by an Israeli company. And, you know, it's kind of like gives you the sense of there's a rhetoric and then there's a reality. And talking about reality, I'm curious about one thing. You talked about this idea of the legacy, the Ottoman legacy in Jerusalem. And I'm sure many listeners and those who go around Jerusalem, when you bump into the Armenian quarters, which I must say often is neglected just because people undertake different kinds of tours of Jerusalem. But there's a striking image walking around the Armenian quarter. There is this small tunnel, and you get to see tons of posters, and these are maps of basically the Armenian genocide, which is a reminder of something that happened. And I think is an important reminder for people about the Armenian genocide, but also the connection between Jerusalem and its history. So I was wondering, to what extent the Armenian genocide affected the Armenian quarter and affected Jerusalem as a city? We are going to take a short break. Thank you for listening. And remember to join our Facebook page, Twitter, and Instagram account. If you have a story about Jerusalem that you want to share, or someone that you want me to interview, please get in touch. Enjoy the rest of the show.
Very good question, Roberto. As a teenager, I was part of our group who put these maps on the wall. But, you know, it's kind of a inheritance, you know, and the younger generation takes over in order to keep the memory alive, I should say. Memory alive for the visitors. Of course, sometimes you have these settlers who would rip them off, and there has been few incidents that they wrote on these maps, you deserve, things like this, you know. And of course, there is a lot of tensions. Usually, Armenian priests are attacked by settlers living in the Jewish quarter. They spit on them, etc. And there is a lot of kind of discrimination, and we don't see any measures being taken by the Israeli government. And that's a different topic we can discuss later. It's a discrimination par excellence, I should say. But coming to Jerusalem, Jerusalem is an important city for the survivors of the Armenian genocide. It was the most important city, I should say, in the Middle East, because it housed thousands and thousands of people who survived the Armenian genocide. Jerusalem is the place that housed 3 to 4 orphanages where Armenian orphans were raised for a few years, including my wife's grandmother, who was a survivor from Van. Her name was Diruhi. And my wife is from Baghdad, actually. And I met her about in 2009. But I didn't know, actually, back then that her grandmother was born and was an orphan in Jerusalem. And there are many stories of Armenians who were orphaned in Jerusalem and raised in the orphanages in the Armenian quarter, but also in the Greek Holy Cross Church near the Knesset, as you know. And so these orphans eventually went to different parts of the world. Some of them went to Cyprus to attend the Melkonian school there, which housed orphans and gave them excellent education. I knew a few orphans, they passed away, most of them in the 90s, but they were all orphans. But the Armenian Patriarchate of Jerusalem in the aftermath of the Armenian genocide played a monumental role in housing, sheltering, providing food to the Armenian survivors. Today, the Armenian culture has about 500 members, maybe. Back then, it used to have 5,000 to 6,000 members living in the Armenian culture. And genocide plays an important role for the Armenians of Jerusalem in their identity, as well in other identities, as well for the Armenians of the other. But there is kind of a physical presence there too, of the remnants of the memories of the Armenians of Jerusalem, the remnants, the buildings which house the Armenian orphans, the buildings, these old small rooms that housed families of two or three, small rooms, people who survived and escaped the genocide. So there is a kind of a very important, deep collective memory of Armenians of Jerusalem being the inheritors of these types of these type of collective memories. But also there is an important fact here, which is the struggle for recognition by the State of Israel of the Armenian genocide. The State of Israel, it's not only that it does not recognize the Armenian genocide, it oscillates between active denialism to passive denialism, to soft denialism, in Holocaust, there is hardcore denialism, to softcore denialism. So Israel oscillates. And now I'm finished editing a book on denial of genocide. And there is an Israeli scholar by the name of Eldad Ben Aharon, actually, who wrote a fascinating article demonstrating how Israel actually uses the Armenian genocide as a pressure card in Turkey, making sure that whenever it passes the bill, whenever it puts the bill on the table of the Knesset, it leads to some type of a pressure on Turkey, and there is a deal that goes on under the table to remove that bill. But the idea here is that they are 100% sure that whenever they put the bill is not going to be passed. So it's kind of a gesture, kind of a political gesture. The only political party which was really dedicated for the Armenian genocide to pass a bill was the Meretz party, the late Chaim Oron. The late Chaim Oron, who is the brother of Yair Oron, who wrote an important two books about the denial of the Israel and Armenian genocide, of the Armenian genocide. But today, the Armenian genocide is being used by right-wing parties, Israel Beitenu Yahadut party, just solely to put pressure on Turkey whenever Turkey starts yelling about Israel committing genocide or that thing. Even, for example, Netanyahu's son, Yair Netanyahu, tweeted about that. There is no sincere approach to the Armenian genocide. And there is a lot of disappointment by the Armenians, not only for the genocide, but also for the active participation with the Azeris in selling them weapons during the Nagorno-Karabakh war that took place last year. So Armenian identity is connected on multiple layers: Jerusalem identity, Palestine identity. Then you have the Israel identity in Jaffa, Haifa, and Tel Aviv. But also there is new identity, which is the Armenians of Petah Tikva. Those Armenians who came after the collapse of the Soviet Union, there is kind of a new identity there. And then there you have another loyalty to Armenia, and then to Artsakh, Nagorno-Karabakh. So all of these create the kind of a complex hybrid identity within Jerusalem with multiple loyalties, and there's the survival game, and there's the balancing game. And so it's a complex thing, and it hasn't been studied thoroughly by an anthropologist. There have been few rudimentary work that has been done, but I think now it's a much more complex situation, And so it's a fascinating case of study, I think, that needs to be analyzed and deconstructed.
You mentioned number and how the community basically got smaller and smaller. You talked about lands, you talked about multiple identities, and I like this idea of micro differences. So I was wondering, what are the challenges in the contemporary period for both Armenian Jerusalem and Armenians as people in Jerusalem?
The main challenge of Armenians in Jerusalem has to do with housing. It's extremely difficult to find housing. And I don't see the Armenian Patriarchate initiating major projects such as the Latin Patriarchate of building housings for Armenians. And as you know, buying a house in West Jerusalem is extremely expensive. We're talking about more than $500,000 for a 70 square foot apartment. And no wonder that Palestinians are not able to get any permissions. And then you have demolitions of homes after home, because first of all, Israeli government would never, rarely, they would provide you with a permission, license to build. And providing a license itself is about $200,000 to $300,000, if not more. And then you don't have an option then build your own house, which is considered quote-unquote illegal by the Israeli government, and they demolish, whereas in West Jerusalem, you can build anything you want, as you know. I mean, it's part of the discrimination, segregation, and we all know about that. But Armenians today suffer the problem of housing, and that's why the community is shrinking. But to that extent, we have to also think about the immigration of Armenians to other parts of the world. The major blow to the Armenians of Jerusalem began in 1948 as the war. Their houses were confiscated by the Israeli government, 1948, followed 1967, but then the first intifada and the second intifada. So if you want me to rank the reasons for the diminution of the Armenian community, I'll start with 1948. Then 1967, the Nakba and the Naksa, and then during the first Intifada, because most Armenians of Jerusalem actually earned their living through tourism, and they were goldsmiths and photographers, ceramicists, etc. So these are connected to tourism, and during the first Intifada, everything collapsed. Once upon a time, 90% of the shops in the Christian quarter and outside the old Jaffa Gate used to be owned by Armenians. 90%. The whole goldsmith market was run by Armenians near the Dabara street. And most of them left. Today you have a handful of Armenians who are there only, you know, and there is today with COVID, it's a more dire situation. But for the Armenians in Haifa, Yaffa, situation is much better, because there is more kind of coexistence there, quote unquote coexistence. But we saw what coexistence in the face of coexistence with the recent events. There is a discrimination, I should say, in these parts of the cities, but it's more dormant discrimination. Not like East Jerusalem. East Jerusalem is a very difficult place to live in, very segregated and very discriminatory place. It's very difficult to buy a house, I should say. You need to be a multimillionaire to be able to buy a house, a regular house, which we would consider a regular house here in the United States, small house. Rents are very expensive. You can't afford rents in West Jerusalem. We're talking about $1,500. And as you know, Armenians are not rich in Old City of Jerusalem. Half of the Armenians work with the Armenian Patriarchate. In the Armenian Patriarchate, that's a quarter, not half, The rest have their own private businesses, which are connected mostly to the tourism industry. Once upon a time, you had major Armenian photographers. Today, as far as I know, the only one who's left is the legendary photo Elia. The Elia Kahvejan, the legendary photographer of the interwar period, and his grandson is running the business until today. And to that extent, the Armenian community has also declined due to the fact of the closing of borders with the neighboring communities, with specifically Lebanon and Syria. And during the Jordanian period and the interwar period, Armenians used to commute freely from Jerusalem to Beirut, to Damascus without any obstacles. And after 1967, this trend was halted due to the Israel. And this was important because when you have a small community, you have limited options of marriage. Hence, a lot of Armenians used to get married prior to 1967, 1948, with Armenian, both women or men, from the communities of Lebanon and Syria. My mother was born in Lebanon, for example, and both parents were born in Lebanon. My father was born in Lebanon too, but he's at the age of one, he came to Palestine at the time. But again, these trends stopped, and now we have a new trend of Armenians now getting married with Armenians, either from Armenians from Armenia, and then you have a major pain in the neck of a bureaucratic procedure, which is a discriminatory procedure of family reunion. As you know, this is the same regarding the Palestinians too, those who are in the West Bank, or those who are in Israel, wants to get married with Armenians. With their relatives in the West Bank or Gaza Strip. You know, it's a major monumental task. You have to go. You have to hire a lawyer. Thousands of dollars go. Whereas an Israeli who wants to marry, bring in another spouse. Just make an aliyah, and it's a 1 week procedure. Whereas if you are a citizen and you want to marry an Armenian from Armenia, it's a major procedure. It's a multiple year procedure. This is part of the discriminatory process, actually aimed at doing their best. The Israeli government's demographic technique, as you know. I mean, there is nothing secret here. Everyone knows about that. So these are parts of the challenges, actually. And if you ask me, I think we need the leadership in Jerusalem, which is only ecclesiastic leadership, to really step up to the challenge and see what the Latin Patriarchate is doing and follow in the footsteps of the Latin Patriarchate by preserving the community, by encouraging the community, by building houses for the community, and not only confine themselves to these small shabby houses that exist in the Armenian convent, which is not able to house even a couple, actually, because it's so small. Once upon a time, it used to house, during the post-genocide period, the whole family itself. But now times have changed, and for Armenians to go out, the only option is to leave Jerusalem and go to Tel Aviv, Haifa, or Yaffa. And that means you are really detaching yourself from an identity that you've been born to, which is Jerusalem identity, leaving your friends and family and going and starting a new life, which is not a new life per se, but still it's considered a new life in a different city where it's not part of that old city culture of the Palestinian Arab culture or Islamic Christian culture. It's a different type of culture.
You mentioned the leadership, and I really wanted to ask you, briefly, I understand the complexity of the topic, but what is the role of the Armenian church, in Jerusalem, and also dealing with the Armenians in Jerusalem, and also dealing now, in the contemporary, dealing with the state of Israel?
The Armenian Patriarchate has priorities. Its first priority is to preserve its right in the holy places, because this is the Saint James Brotherhood. It was established in the 14th century. A patriarchate was established in the 14th century. Before that, in the 7th century, we had a bishop in Jerusalem, but eventually, first aim is to preserve the Armenian religious rights in Jerusalem based on the status quo post the Crimean War, and to preserve a strong ecclesiastic presence by running its institutions, most importantly, the seminary, which once upon a time used to bring students from Turkey, followed by Lebanon, and now from Armenia. The aim of this seminary is to keep the kind of the soldiers, the Armenian ecclesiastic soldiers who would protect the Armenian presence in Jerusalem, ecclesiastic religious presence, it's a kind of a school, actually. It's a seminary where they learn everything and they graduate to become either priests or part of the brotherhood. But most of them actually, after graduation, leave back to Armenia. The whole idea is that if you have 40 students and you can get 2 priests after them, that's an achievement. So the Armenian Patriarchate runs major institutions. These include, but not limited to the Armenian school, both schools, ecclesiastic and national school, the Armenian Library, Gulbenkian Library, the Armenian Museum, which is going to be open very soon with a new kind of design, hopefully attract more tourists in order to teach them about the Armenian history. And Armenian history is not about genocide, it's about thousands of years of culture, about language, about heritage, legacies. Then you have the Armenian Manuscript Library, which is the most important manuscript library after Armenia, after the Madenataram, the Armenian National Library, Armenian Library in Manuscript Library in Armenia. And then you have the seminary school, and then you have a major important thing of an access of income is the Armenian real estate, which is mostly housed in West Jerusalem. And I think these real estate is an extremely important, very contentious and critical issue for the Armenians in Jerusalem in general. Many years ago, I wrote an article, what I don't know, 15 years ago, called Reform in the Armenian Quarter of Jerusalem, which I suggested that there needs to be transparency about dealing with real estate. Because anything happens with the real estate is that the Armenian community would be the forefront paying the price for it. Whether, you know, it's a very critical issue. And I do still believe that there needs to be transparency. There needs to be a lay community body who would in tandem play the role of either advisory council to the real estate body. But recently, there has been a lot of discontent by the Palestinians. And this is not something secret. You can find it on Facebook, of Armenian Patriarchate making deals with the municipality. And I'm not going to go into details here, but everyone knows about this. And Armenian Patriarchate issued a few statements denying these allegations or claims. But future would be which show what's happening actually, but that's why I think we need a lay body to work with the real estate director and the committee in order to make sure that such things do not happen, because it did happen in the 70s and 80s. The prime real estates of the Armenian Patriarchate went to either settlers or Israeli municipality or Israeli government or Israeli real estate agencies, and millions of dollars were skimmed. And this is not only endemic to the Armenian Patriarchate. As you remember, it happened also in the Greek Patriarchate with the most important the Gloria Hotel, near the Jaffa Gate, and the Petra Hotel, and still I don't know what happened with it. It's in dispute. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that the purchase was legal by the Israeli settlers. And, you know, so in order to avoid these types of things, I think we need to have more transparency as to happening, because the last thing we would like to hear is that Armenians are traitors and they sold the cause, whereas Armenian community in general is part and parcel of the Palestinian culture and of Jerusalem and Palestinian cause, and that's part of it. I think that's the very important aspect, to try to include the Armenian community in the decision making process of the Armenian Patriarchate.
We're running out of time, but I have two more questions.
Sure, go ahead.
One is very much about your work. You've wrote about your first book, Shattered Dreams of Revolution, was very much about the 1908 constitutional revolution in the Ottoman Empire. And then the second book that you have, it's, and I mentioned at the beginning, the co-edited work, Routledge Handbook on Jerusalem, which I really suggest all of the listeners to get a copy, because you get a good history of Jerusalem, but not also from a chronological point of view, but also from a thematic perspective. What's next? What's the next project?
Actually, I co-edited another book, which is Challenges in Western Armenian in the 21st Century, with Barlow Dermagerdichan. I published by the press at the California State University of Fresno. There was another book of the Armenian. I edited another book on which was published last year, which is called Armenian, the Republic of Armenian in its Centenary: Politics, Gender, and Culture. I think, but there are two books that are forthcoming. One of them is called The Horrors of Adana, which is about the Adana massacres. It's in production now. It's going to be published by Stanford University Press in March. And there is another book that I edited. Hopefully it's going to be published next year by, which is done actually, we're going to publish by University of Nebraska Press. So there are two books in the pipeline. One of them is in production, coming up in March of 2020. Which is, I think, I consider an important book of reanalyzing the Adana massacres that took place in 1909 in the region of Cilicia. It's called Violence and Revolution at the End of the, in the beginning of the 20th century. Otherwise, projects, I'm thinking now of concentrating on back to Jerusalem, analyzing intercommunal relationships, because I have an advantage, not only linguistic advantage, but being part of, as a subject also, you know, growing up in that history. And a lot of things haven't changed in terms of interactions, and maybe times have changed, politics have changed, but still the basis remain there, you know, neighborhoods, communities, and I would like to pay more attention to that.
My last question takes you back at the very beginning. You mentioned your grandmother, and you mentioned food. So I was wondering, is there any Armenian Jerusalemite food that you are missing while you're sitting in Lincoln, Nebraska?
Don't open my wounds, please. I miss my mom's food, actually, because she learned it from my grandmother. So it's kind of my grandmother. See, my mom also is from Marash, you know, so the whole family is from Marash. You know, mother's side, father's side, they're from Marash. So there is the Marash cuisine, actually, which has to do with crack wheat yogurt soup. There is the zucchini stew, many lahmacun, for example, the keftas. There's tons of things I miss, actually, and But also, I have to frankly say that I miss the hummus of Abu Shukri, which is in the old city of Jerusalem. And I did grow up like 10 meters from that place. And you would see our balcony. If you stand, you will see Abu Shukri from our balcony, actually. And that's kind of my pilgrimage, too. When I go there, their hummus and falafel are excellent. And of course, I do have four places that I visit on hummus. It's Abu Shukri, it's Lina, it's Kamel, and it's Arafat. All of them are the most important hummus places within the old city of Jerusalem. The falafel is the same. Abu Shukri is the best. And next is the shawarma. And shawarma is excellent. Specifically the shawarma of Shu'le in East Jerusalem, in the Salah al-Din Street. So these are the two things that I miss outside the house, actually. And I'm looking forward to them, you know. Because in the United States, whoever does hummus, whoever claims to be doing hummus, whoever claims is doing falafel is actually not close to anything. If you are from the heart of the cuisine, then nothing would satisfy you except the heart itself.
This was Bedros Dermatosyan, currently Associate Professor of Modern Middle Eastern History at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, but more importantly, an Armenian Jerusalemite. Bedros, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Roberto, for inviting me. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thank you for listening to Jerusalem Unplugged. This podcast is currently commercial-free. There are no ads. The only possibility to stay this way is for you to please let your friends, your family, and others who may be interested in listening to Jerusalem Unplugged know about this podcast. Let's increase the audience and let's keep the podcast commercial free. Thank you for listening. Until the next one.